Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some of the residents, artists, and writers at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Right now, I would like to welcome Emily Houses. She's a doctoral student at Yale University School of Nursing, and she's studying cancer pain in the American Indians of northern New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Great to have you here. So you're from New Mexico. How did you get interested in the whole subject of cancer and cancer pain?
Oh, boy. I think that I was first interested in it when we lost my grandfather. He had colon cancer, and he died in 1994. My grandfather was Alan Houser. And it was a really big deal for my family. It was a really big deal for me. I was, I think, 20 years old at the time, and it just really shook my soul. And so that interested me in cancer and end-of-life care. And after a couple of tries of different careers, I ended up as a nurse, going to Yale School of Nursing.
And so when a person has cancer, what is the nature of the pain that they're feeling?
There are different kinds of pain that go along with cancer. There's the pain that we all think of just off the top of your head, just, you know, like when you cut yourself, that's a pain. And so there's that pain, but there's also other pains. There's the spiritual pain that happens. There's this kind of existential pain that happens when people are going through a life-threatening disease. And the pains are, they're multidimensional.
And so as a nurse, and for you, having been through this family connection and so on, you're thinking of pain in the broader context, not
absolutely.
Just the physical pain.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that that's really an indigenous approach to any sort of illness, is that it's not just about the physical. It's about all of these different things. It's the spiritual. It's what's happening in the outer world that also is affecting the body.
So that said, let's talk about the physical pain for a moment. What are some of the drugs, the kinds of drugs that are used to treat physical pain when people have cancer?
Standardly, people get opioids for their pain, either a short-acting or a long-acting opioid. Other drugs that work really well for most cancer pain, or for bone pain in particular, are NSAIDs, things like Motrin or ibuprofen. And sometimes there, if you have nerve pain, there's another kind of drug that's that works on the nervous system and helps with that kind of pain as well.
And doctors are trained to know what types of drugs work best for what types of pain.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a standard.
And nurses, I guess, hospice nurses and
absolutely.
So on. So what are the, you know, what kind of cultural differences have you seen in the way that people take those drugs or use those kinds of drugs or not, you don't use them?
Well, different cultures respond in different ways to pain, and some people in some cultures respond, and this is pain, it needs to be fixed, there are solutions, I can go to the doctor, I can ask for a pain medication, and it's going to be fixed, and if it's not fixed, then it's somebody else's problem, and it's their fault that I'm suffering. Other people, other cultural
groups... Well, would you characterize that sort of white America kind of thing?
The research goes back to the 50s, and there are different sort of white American groups that have that approach. And there's a great study that happened in the 1950s where a researcher went and looked at Italian Americans and Jewish Americans, I think, and a couple of different groups in the Northeast, and they were able to characterize, according to how people responded to pain, what culture they were going to be from.
Really?
Yeah, it was really fascinating.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So people respond to pain in a pretty consistent way through their culture.
And so you having studied, not only being from a Native family, but studying them, you went, one of your experiences was in Montana.
Yes.
As a student.
Yes, so I went to Montana for my master's degree doing research, talking to the American Indians in the southeastern corner of Montana, the Crow and Northern Cheyenne mostly. And they were very, what they like to characterize themselves as being very stoic. They didn't want to respond to their pain. They thought that showing their pain indicated that they were weak.
Men and women both.
Men and women both, yes. And as a result, what they would do, instead of complaining about their pain and getting it treated, they would suffer in silence, and they became very isolated as a result.
Do you know what the cultural roots of that way of dealing with pain are?
That's a very good question. Not entirely sure why, because I didn't have time to explore that so much. And so it could just be that Well, actually, one of the things that they said was that they didn't want people to talk about them. And in small communities, and this happens all over, it's not just Indian communities, but people are very nervous about gossip, and they feel like gossip is very destructive, and so the best way to avoid that is to just completely isolate yourself, because if nobody's talking about you, if they can't see you, they can't talk about you.
And if you're not doing anything for them to talk about, right. They're less likely to talk about you.
Exactly.
Very interesting. So there's also this issue of death being part of everybody's life journey.
Mm-hmm. That's something that I'm finding here, and it's fascinating that a lot of the people that I talk to, they're not complaining about their pain and they're not talking about their pain because they don't feel like it's something that should be treated because it's part of their life's path. And if their path is to go through life and to have this experience with this disease and to die from the disease, because they're expecting to die from the disease, and if part of dying from the disease is experiencing excruciating pain, then that's what they need to do. And it's part of a spiritual journey for them. It's frustrating for me as an oncology person because we have such great tools. I feel like, in fact, if we were to treat that pain and help them through that pain, they could experience that journey even more so or more acutely because they wouldn't be focusing on the pain the whole time.
We're talking to Emily Houses. So this is a kind of communication project that you're engaged in, basically giving that message over. How much of a difference does it make if that message comes from you, an American Indian, versus from somebody else?
We can hypothesize that if we do more teaching from Indians than to Indians, you know, if you do teaching within your own culture, you're going to get a better result. But the truth of the matter is we have so few American Indian healthcare practitioners that we haven't been able to really test that.
So in what context are you actually working right now?
Right now I'm doing strictly research, well, almost strictly research. So I'm interviewing people in the area about my research so I can learn more and use this in the future. I'm interviewing both healthcare providers and people who are living with cancer pain right now, mostly American Indians who are living with cancer pain.
What kind of misconceptions are you finding, if any, that they have about pain and drugs?
A lot of people, both on both sides, the healthcare providers and the patients, have this real strong worry that they're going to become addicted to these drugs, when in fact that's not the case. When we look at the research, we find that when you take opioids, you know, things like morphine or OxyContin or any of those, when you take those for a legitimate pain that you're experiencing and you stop taking it when you don't have the pain anymore, you aren't addicted. It's when people who take the drugs for other reasons, they take it to get high, they take it for whatever, because it makes them feel good, those are the people who become addicted. But people with cancer pain almost never become addicted to their drugs.
So if the pain goes away, they stop taking it,
yes.
They're not addicted. Is that difference a physiological difference?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that something you can explain to the lay people listening?
That would be tough for me right now. But, you know, I'm not entirely sure the mechanism there. All I know is that when you take pain medication for pain, it helps the pain go away.
And so, like, it gets used up for the
right.
pain and not
exactly.
for the highness or the
right.
whatever.
Right.
Very interesting. So, are there barriers that you've seen, for example, in Native communities about trusting, you know, nurses and doctors and so on from the outside versus traditional healers?
Well, yeah. Let's see. Are there barriers to trusting? Well, there are always barriers to trusting outsiders. In a population where there's been a lot of exploitation and abuse, they have every reason to be distrustful. And so it's very hard for a family who's seen generations of abuse or perceived abuse, because it's happened in both ways, from the outside it's very hard for them to trust somebody who's coming into their home and saying, your family member is very ill, they're probably going to die, we want to give them these drugs. And when we had really unethical research in the past, people it's hard for them to reconcile their feelings of distrust with their feelings of wanting to care for their family member.
Do you find that the people whom you are working with are at home or in hospital settings mostly?
I've been talking, for this research that I'm speaking about today, I've been talking mostly to people either in their homes or while they're getting outpatient chemotherapy. So not a lot of hospitalized people.
What role does the quality of care and the funding of care for Indian people play in this whole question?
That's the crucial piece there. Because of the way the Indian Health Service is funded, a lot of people end up getting diagnosed with their disease a lot later than they would if they weren't seeking care from the Indian Health Service. It's a real long story with a heavy systemic cause here, but the end result is that American Indians are diagnosed later in their disease, and so they have a more serious diagnosis as a result, which means then because you get diagnosed with cancer at a later stage, your chances of surviving that cancer are very, very minimal.
And so you have more people basically dying of cancer than there would be if
exactly.
It was caught at an earlier stage.
Exactly. The deaths from cancer are higher for American Indians because they are diagnosed at later stages.
I don't know if this is part of your work, but what can be done about that, or what kind of movements are afoot to have more checkups and more early diagnosis?
There's really good services out there right now to try and get people in for early screening. Things like mammograms and teaching young men how to do testicular self-exams, teaching women to keep track of their bodies and monitor their breast health, making sure that everybody goes in to do all those screenings that they need to do, the colonoscopies, the pap smears. All of those things are really important, and they're doing really good work at that kind of preventive when they can, those preventative teachings. But the problem is that a lot of people aren't really receptive to that. Because they don't trust the system in the first place, it's hard to get them in. Or they just don't have access. They can't get to the doctor. They go to the doctor once a year for an emergency. There's just not that time.
So it's the services are available, but they're not used to their capacity.
Right. The services are available. They're not used to their capacity. There's a lot of difficulty with access. You know, a lot of people don't have cars. They live a long way out, away from town. I've talked to people who live up in Taos who need to go down to Albuquerque for certain treatments, and they just can't get there, so they don't. And things that could be curable or avoidable end up being terminal.
Then there's also the issue of which facility they go to. We were talking the other day about how people who've been going to the Indian Health Service the other day don't want to go to St. Vincent's because it's just going to St. Vincent's has a lot of baggage.
Right, and you can imagine, this is the case for me, and it's a case for many people, that you've been going to one healthcare provider from the moment you were born, one place, and for me, I can only really speak about myself or my family, but we always went to the Indian Health Service for our care, for primary care, for anything, and anytime anybody had to go to St. Vincent's, it was because they were really, really sick. And so there's that stigma about St. Vincent's, and it has nothing to do with the care that's provided at St. Vincent's. I think they deliver excellent care. It's just that because you're going out of the system to an unfamiliar place where they don't know you, they don't know your traditions, they don't know who your grandparents were, you know, they don't treat your brother, that it's really seen as a place of last resort.
And so the whole web of connection, family and community, is very much a part of what you're looking at in healthcare.
Absolutely, absolutely. I came into this wanting to talk to people about cancer pain, and I'm finding that the story goes much deeper than just a matter of a little bit of pain in your back from your disease.
So say more about that.
Well, I'm finding that the underfunding of IHS has a lot to do with this. There's a lot of distrust between the patients and the care providers, mostly the patients not trusting the care providers. There's a lot of there are a lot of barriers to receiving quality care, and they come from both sides. And so this tiny little thing that I wanted to look at, what I called a focus ethnography, has become this gigantic, all-encompassing example of how there's so much disparity in healthcare for American Indians.
I think that another part of the conversation, which is very important, is the whole conversation, talking and listening among doctors, patients, mm-hmm. nurses, and other caregivers.
Yeah, we talked about this the other day. There's a communication barrier that it's. I'm not even quite sure. I mean, there's the obvious communication barrier because there's a language barrier for a lot of people, but it goes deeper than that. It's a place where The healthcare providers are speaking in a lot of jargon and they talk really fast. And when we know this for all populations, when you're diagnosed with something like cancer, there's so much going on and there's so many big words and it's a completely other world that unless you are a very motivated self-learner, it's very hard to keep up with everything that's going on. It's easy to become complacent or to fall between the cracks.
And to let the doctor say and that is what's going to happen to you.
Right. And, you know, they're perfectly qualified to do that. But we're in a system, in our Western medical system, where the doctors are expecting the patients to interact a little bit and to have some say in their care. And in fact, we should expect that. But that sort of wave of medical care and medical culture hasn't caught up in the Indian community.
So in terms of the kind of conversations that are happening in the Indian community between, among doctors, nurses, and patients, how do you see your role and other people doing the kind of thing you're doing in really fostering better communications?
How do I see my role? Well, the first thing I want to do is finish this research that I'm working on now so I can publish it so that I can, and also so I can go out and start presenting this information so I can teach clinicians, so I can teach that side. This is what our population, Indian people, are expecting. This is the way we can better treat them. These are the things that we can do to help their pain, to help their whole idea of what to expect of cancer. So that's what I wanted to do now. In the long run, I want to also work in developing materials and educational things to help teach Indian people about how to advocate for their own care, what to expect when they go to the doctor, how to ask questions of the doctor, because that's another thing that's really hard for some people, is to challenge this authority figure.
It's hard for a lot of people from all cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, especially when this authority figure is coming at you with all these big words and so much more knowledge than you have.
Well, I would think a piece of it would be also training the doctors in that kind of sensitivity.
Yeah, yeah. And that's part of what I'm doing with my presentations to the healthcare providers.
So what is the nature of your research? I know that you want to make a call out to people so that they can also participate if they want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm doing right now is I'm talking to people, Indian people, who are going through cancer pain, going through the experience of cancer, and trying to get them to talk to me so that I can learn more about their experiences. And I'm hoping that people will hear this morning and think, oh, this brought up something in my head, and they'll give me a call, and we'll give them that number, I guess, later on.
Yeah.
So I want those people to know that that I can give them a voice. And that's what I want to do. I feel like that's my job here. I've got a gift that I've got this great education, and I want to make sure that I can use it.
Are you planning on staying in New Mexico?
Oh, absolutely. This is my home. I couldn't live anywhere else. I tried, and I didn't succeed.
New Haven, Connecticut.
Yeah, no. You have to see the sky every morning, or else it's just not a good day.
We're talking to Emily Houses, and she's a doctoral student at Yale University School of Nursing, studying, well, far more than cancer pain in the American Indians of northern New Mexico. What have been your biggest surprises in the work that you're doing?
There have been a lot of surprises, and that's a great question. One of the things, and I knew this was true, but I found that where the Indians in Montana wanted to be identified as stoic, that was something that was a value for them that they thought was really important. In New Mexico, I've seen a lot of people really shy away from that word. They don't want to be seen as stoic. They think that's kind of an insult, and it's an easy way out from getting the right kind of care. So that was really surprising for me.
So how did they want to be seen instead?
They want to be seen as experiencing this journey, and that the pain is part of the journey. They don't want to be seen as suffering, and they don't want to be seen as suffering in silence, which I think stoicism can mean to some people. They want to be seen as strong.
It's interesting because they're both ways of refusing medication, but they have a very different feeling to that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've seen on the nursing side that often what care providers will do is say, oh, that patient is really stoic, and leave it at that and not explore what's going on with the patient as a result.
I think one of the things that's hard about this, too, is that when you are a patient or somebody in your family is a patient, you're really not sharing information with other patients and other families in any kind of direct way, whereas when you're in a you know, a work situation, or you're a musician, or any number of other things, there's forums for sharing mm-hmm. in a way that there aren't, because it seems so personal and so private.
Yeah, yeah. And I think suffering is personal and private. But that's another thing that's really surprised me, is that when I talk to people here who are dealing with cancer pain, at the time, they'll say, no, I'm telling my family. I'm telling everybody. I want them to do something about it. But then when we actually look at the level of pain they're experiencing and what they're going through are things that we know are very painful, they will deny having pain. So theoretically, they'll say, oh, if I was suffering, I would tell my mother, I would tell my sister, I would tell my wife, and I'd have no problem with it. But when you actually ask them, are you going through pain right now, they'll say no.
And they are.
Yeah. Well, we can assume that they are, given what we know about their diagnosis.
Now, have you had these situations where you have worked with people and say, why don't you try this medication, and it really does ease their journey?
I haven't gotten to that place yet, because I'm not working clinically, so I can't, yeah.
So in the long run, do you think you will be working clinically?
I do want to work clinically, and that's some place where I feel like I can use this information that I've learned to actually have one-on-one care and improve people's lives that way.
Emily, what is the way to contact you if people who are listening would like to either have a conversation with you or write to you about the work you're doing?
My phone number, it's a local cell phone number in Santa Fe, 505-501-9095.
And that's 501-9095.
Yes, thank you. That's a confidential voicemail or cell phone. So if you reach me off the top, that's great. But you can also leave a message. Or you can, if you have access to the internet, you can email me. And my email address is emily.haozous@gmail.com.
And Emily Houses.
Oh, sorry. Wait, let me. Instead of .gmail, do the Yale. That's my school address.
Okay.
Yale.edu. That's Yale.edu.
Emily.houses@yale.edu.
Yeah.
And if anybody wants more information, or if they haven't gotten the phone numbers or anything, they can always write to me also at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Emily Houses, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I'd like now to welcome the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute. There will be an open studios in which the residents will be showing their work and reading from their work this Thursday, tomorrow at 5:30 in the afternoon. And I'd like right now to welcome Michael Broman. He's an artist, architect, sculptor. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So do you consider yourself primarily a sculptor?
Yes, primarily a sculptor, yeah. I haven't done architecture in many years. I got my master's of architecture and then worked as an architect for a year and then quickly got out of that.
And so tell us about the kind of work that you're doing now. I've seen some of your work in the past, and there's a lot of bodies and body parts.
Kind of macabre.
A little macabre, or more than a little.
Well, the work that I'm doing here at the Santa Fe Art Institute is, my proposal was to go through the trash cans of Santa Fe and go through the garbage and pick up refuse. And I kind of think of it more as artifacts. And the reason I wanted to do that was because the locale of Santa Fe is so full of history and so full of artifacts. But I was looking for contemporary artifacts. So I'm going through driving the roads, finding things that have been thrown away, going through dumpsters, going to flea markets, thrift stores, bringing those back to the studio, and then trying to make sense of those. I just went to a great auction the other day for the Fish and Game Department. They were auctioning off illegally poached animal remains.
And, good heavens.
And I bought a truckload of elk skulls and horns that still have the flesh on it, and one of them had barbed wire wrapped around the horns because that one had gotten caught in the fence. And so I'm combining those with some of the materials that I collected. And, you know, I don't quite know what I'm doing with these yet, but I'm just collecting them, trying to find stories, because every object has a story behind it.
Are you trying to find the actual stories, or are you making them up?
Both. I'm trying to find the actual ones. Like, some of them, I found an old burnt house that had, it's weird, it had literally been burnt down and scooped up and dumped on the side of the road. So there's throughout, maybe...
You mean they moved it?
They moved a house.
They burnt it first and then moved it.
There was a house that burnt somewhere. It was between Chimayo Española. And it must have burnt somewhere else, but they picked it up in a dumpster and dumped it on the side of the road. So I've been kind of rummaging through that, bringing burnt wood back. So I don't know the story behind that. I just know that was a house that had burnt, had been dumped, and now I'm getting the burnt timbers and some objects that I collect from that and putting that together with some of the other objects I get. And so most of it's made up stories, but I'm trying to be true to the material, looking at it saying this is a burnt house. There's so much story behind it. Somebody lived here.
Do you try to find the things that still survived and that are treasures somehow, or are you like really going for the destroyed things?
Both, because I don't think I can really separate those. Because the things that I'm picking up right now, a lot of them are in a state of decay, but there's still remnants there. There's still stories there. There's still so much left of it, and part of my ideas in making a work is that I approach it and not wanting to have a one-liner or a single answer, like people look at it and say, oh, I get that. I want them to have so many different viewpoints and come at it from different angles and not necessarily give them the answer. So I'm trying to capture some of their associations with it, capture some of their memories with it, but also pay tribute to the material in itself and the history of the material, and hopefully try to wrap those two up together.
Does smell play a role?
Yes. unintentionally at times. The burnt wood actually isn't an offensive smell to most people, so the burnt wood actually does have that burnt smell. The elk heads that I have right now that still have the hide on it, it's kind of a nasty smell.
Mm-hmm.
That will dissipate with time. But I haven't quite resolved how to really incorporate that into it in a way that people will choose to get up close to it.
Well, I would think that to some extent you have to kind of de-stinkify it.
I do. I have this material, this liquid that I got from an online taxidermy supply store, and it's antibacterial, antimicrobial that I can spray on it, and it kills the bacteria and takes the smell away. The smell is. I mean, and that's just one part of my work. I don't do all stinky work.
Right, right.
I do need to deal with that, and as I live with it for a little bit in the studio, then I have to see what part I'm attracted to, what part that kind of repels me as an artist, and work with that.
So when you conceive of a piece like this, this is not something that people decorating their living rooms are going to presumably purchase.
Some will. I don't think I'm not the type of artist that people come to and say, make me a pretty piece. My philosophy is that beauty is very much a byproduct of the process. So I go through the process, I start to get my own vocabulary and allow the materials to have their own vocabulary. And that the language of my material may not be something that everyone understands, but those who do understand it really don't mind living with my work. And I think, for me as an artist, the beauty for my work is that it's a very honest approach to it. It's a very, I'm very true to the materials. And I think a lot of people do appreciate that.
I was wondering that when I was looking at some of the work with the little, I don't know if they were babies or fetuses.
Oh, the chickababies.
Yes.
They're hybrids of chicken bodies and baby heads.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Right. And thinking, there's the process that you go through in making them, then there's the exhibition process, and then there's whatever happens to those things, objects afterwards.
Then there's the storage problem, the huge storage problem of what do I do with them afterwards. So I do sell some of those. Amazingly enough, the chickababies, actually, people either love those or they hate those. And that's part of what I try to do is to really look, when I talk about not wanting to have one liner, I want people to look at it and really think about their own biases or their own baggage, and think, why do they value one thing over another? Why do they devalue one thing over another? One of the materials I worked with last summer was just horse manure and cow manure, and I was making sculptures out of that. And
talk about stink.
No, actually, amazingly enough, it doesn't. It was dry. Well, it started out wet, and then as it dries, it doesn't smell. And part of the reason I really wanted to work with that was, and a lot of the other works, is that people approach it and they have an immediate reaction to it, but then as they start to look at it, they can see some of the beauty in it. And with the horse manure, I was kind of working very specifically with, why do we value like a cast bronze or some like a welded steel sculpture versus something that's made out of horse manure? And a huge percentage of the world population uses cow manure or horse manure on a daily basis to live in, to make fences with, to fertilize it. And I really wanted people to kind of look at that and say, what's the history of this? Why can't this be an amazing sculpture? Why can't this be a relevant work of art just because it's made out of horse dung?
Michael Broman is a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and he will be showing his work along with the other residents this Thursday from 5:30 on. And we're going to take a little break right now and talk to a couple of the other residents. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Alana DiGiacomo. She is a writer, and she is also at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So what kind of writing are you working on these days?
Right now I'm working on a nonfiction book about four teenagers growing up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is a neighborhood of Brooklyn. And I came across them because I teach at an alternative high school for 17 to 21-year-olds in Brooklyn, and these are four of my students.
How did you choose those four?
I wanted to show a range of experiences and personalities that reflected the very diverse population of the New York City's public school system, which is the largest school system in the country and the most troubled. I teach at a school for 17 to 21-year-olds, and so when I tell people this, they're always surprised that people...
It's a public school for college-age students.
Right, but they're still in high school.
Okay.
And for many of them, it's their third or fourth high school, and they've either been kicked out of their previous high schools or dropped out, had babies, been incarcerated, are recent immigrants. It's a range of reasons why they're there, but people don't realize that there's this need for students to remain in public school for those extra 4 years. So that's why I started writing the book. And I chose students who, one is a recent immigrant from Jamaica. One has lived in Bed-Stuy her whole life and sort of grappled with depression and not having parents around and being raised by her grandmother. One is in foster care and was abused. And one is a lesbian who had to deal with coming out and being thrown out of her house and being homeless. So I chose two boys, two girls, and just different experiences that sort of encapsulate the experiences of my students overall.
You have what people might call a stressful job.
Yes, I would call it a stressful job as well.
What do you teach?
I teach English and documentary film.
And so what is your relationship like with these students, and how do you find the ways in for people who, you know, are presumably troubled for all the reasons that you just explained?
Well, it was a process. I've been doing it for 5 years, and when I started, I had very little experience, and I was only 25, so only 4 years older than some of my students, and I looked 4 years younger than some of my students, and it was intimidating. I think there's a sort of like deprogramming and reprogramming that has to happen, where they come from schools where they're in classes with like 38 other students and they don't really have to do any work. They can just hide in the back, and if they're nice enough or quiet enough, they can just get an A. So once you understand that...
You get an A for being nice and quiet in New York?
Well, yeah, in overcrowded public schools you do, because teachers don't, they're so overwhelmed. You have teachers who have like 250 students a day, and they just can't really keep track of all the students, and it can be a really chaotic situation. So it's hard to, I think, grade accurately in that situation, and this is why a lot of the students end up dropping out and coming to our school. And we have a lot smaller classes. That's part of our philosophy. A lot of individualized instruction and personal attention. So that's sort of how we work with them. The classes are longer, the classes are smaller. We get their parents involved, we get their family friends involved, and we stay on them. We call them every day if they're not in school.
Would you like to read a piece of your writing?
Sure. I'll read an excerpt. It's about one of my students, Desiree. And this is a story about her first high school that she went to before she transferred to Brooklyn Academy. It's called Canarsie High School, and it's one of the largest public high schools in Brooklyn. And it's actually being closed down now because it's so dangerous. It's being closed down in 2009, but she went in 2004 to 2006. So it was at sort of the height of its mayhem.
And this
mayhem.
Is one of your four characters.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
We're talking to Alana DiGiacomo.
Desiree looked forward to increased freedom of body and mind, a time when she could go where she pleased and learn what she wanted. When she finally got to high school, she certainly went where she pleased, and she learned what she wanted, which turned out to be very little. Desiree's view of her early high school years is marked by an astounding lack of discussion about academics. Her resistance to high school began as she exploited the very freedom for which she had yearned. Her accounts of her first high school focus on the tactics she used to avoid going to class, a goal that was disconcertingly easy to achieve. She would play cards with her friends in the lunchroom, where the students were scanned for weapons as they entered the building. Then she would sign in at the front desk so that the attendance office wouldn't call her mother to report her as absent, and spend the remainder of the school day going to all of the lunch periods. Or she spent her time in the hallways with her many friends and crushes. During an interview, Desiree gleefully takes me through her high school day. All right, a regular day for me. I would wake up at about 10. Depending on what I do, if I watch TV, I'm not going to school till about 1. If I don't watch TV, I'll go straight to school and I'll stay in school till all my friends come. Then we'll play around in the hallways with the boys until it's time to go home. Desiree and her friends got along with the security guards, most of whom were graduates of the high school and were barely older than the students, and who therefore did not force them into their classes. The long, dimly lit hallways with their chipped pastel yellow and blue paint and bright construction-papered bulletin boards became a playground for the teenagers. They would run along the shiny and battered linoleum floors, pop their heads through the openings of classroom doors to distract the few friends who actually went to class, and slide down the halls on fire extinguisher foam. These are her fondest memories of school. I used to go to school just to have fun, she tells me. Desiree says that her high school held 2,500 students and that there were 38 to 40 students in each class. The quality of the education there, she says, could be summed up in one word, poor. While she thought the new challenges and freedoms of junior high had been a preview of even more liberation to come, she found herself to be sadly mistaken. The curriculum ranged from repetitive to non-existent, with teachers simply writing notes on the board for students to mindlessly copy and never look at again. Beleaguered teachers spoke frantically and loudly, even shouted in futile attempts to be heard over the oppressive noise of students talking, laughing, carving names into desks, playing spades, and doing anything, anything except what they were supposed to be doing. Many of the teachers had stopped trying to speak at all. They simply sat casually at their desks, chatting with favorite students, or sat defeated, reading the tabloids and staring vacantly into space.
Oh my goodness. Alana DiGiacomo talking about the schools in New York City where she is a public school teacher. And unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about it more right now, but people can come to the Santa Fe Art Institute on Thursday at 5:30. You and others will be reading and presumably lots of time for conversation as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Alana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take another little break right now. We'll be right back in about 30 seconds. I'd like now to welcome artist Donna Ruff. She is another resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, you have worked for, I guess, always with paper. Is that correct? That's your main medium?
Yeah, well, paper is my main medium. And my grandparents had a scrap paper company in Chicago. And so when I was very little, I used to go to the warehouse, and they were always giving me pieces of paper. And my mother thinks that that's why I became an artist, but I guess it's kind of in my genes because my great-grandfather, who I never knew, was a bookbinder in Russia. And so his son, my grandfather, came here and he didn't have the education, you know, that he needed. So they opened the scrap paper company. And my grandmother on my father's side used to take the encyclopedias that were sent to the scrap paper company, which had been sliced so that they couldn't be resold, and she used to tape them back together page by page.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So that the family could read the encyclopedia.
Right. The first time I was given a set of World Book encyclopedias that were new, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world.
And you sat there reading them.
Well, yeah, I just thought that was like such a prize. The pages weren't stuck together, for one thing.
Right. Now, tell us about what you're working on now, which is, I think, a bit of a departure from other work you've done.
Right. Well, my proposal when I applied for the Institute residency was to work with the sun. I live in Brooklyn. We have sun there, but not, you know, on a regular
not
basis.
This kind of sun.
Not this kind of sun. And because the last couple of years I've been working on drawings that I've actually burned into paper using a little tool that's a very sharp point. So
which
I've
makes
been
a sort of weirdly skin-like texture.
Yes, I think of paper as being like skin, and I very often use handmade papers that are translucent like skin. But the images themselves that I've been working with are based on calligraphic marks that I've made, which I've scanned into the computer and then sort of doubled and quadrupled so that they create this this pattern that sort of suggests Islamic patterning, which sort of brings me to the project that I'm doing here. Since 2001, I'm sort of backtracking a little bit, but since 2001, especially in New York, there has been such a demonization of all things Islamic. As a Jew, I find it very difficult to reconcile kind of what's going on between the cultures of Judaism and Islam, which have so many similarities, especially in sort of religious texts. And so I'm really exploring the confluence of those two cultures. And what I'm doing at the Institute is making cyanotypes, which are photographically made with the sun. So in my mind, I'm still using a burning kind of thing, but it's being burned by the sun. The cyanotypes have a very strong blue color. And I've been working with the idea of tiles and mosques. There are many mosques that are almost completely blue. Blue is an important color, obviously, for religious, buildings. And so the colors are so beautiful, and the patterns come from the patterns that I had created for my burn drawings. So what I'm going to be doing is an installation with these different patterns in little square tiles. And I'm also doing some works on paper with...
Are the cyanotypes going to be on actual tiles or always on paper?
No, they're still going to be on paper. I tried it on tiles. It's kind of hard, and it's not really doing what I wanted to do anyway. You know, one great thing about paper, I mean, Mike was talking about storage. When I do an installation and it's on paper, I roll it up and throw it somewhere. You know, so it really, and because I drove out here from New York and I expect to sort of throw everything in the car and just go back home. So all these little tiles would just go in a big box. So it'll be very practical.
So it's the kind of thing where you kind of have to see it. I mean, I've seen it only through pictures so far. You kind of have to see it in person because they feel a little bit like stained glass. They feel a little bit like organic, natural pattern mm-hmm. type of designs.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with the patterns themselves? I mean, as probably many people listening know, a cyanotype is a process by which you mask part of the paper and mm-hmm. then the rest of it is exposed to the sun. And
right.
then the part that's exposed to the sun comes out blue, and the other part comes out the color of the paper.
Right, exactly.
So how do you make the designs?
Well, the designs actually are from those calligraphic patterns that
okay.
I was using for the burn drawing. So they tend to be almost like Celtic knotting sort of repeating patterns, and they're really very elaborate. And so I'm working with experimenting with the exposures and the amount of solution on the paper, the different kinds of paper, to get this kind of variation in the blues. And I think they're really beautiful. I mean, one of the things that I really am interested in is to make something beautiful so that people want to spend some time with it. And they're very delicate and intimate. So hopefully people will spend some time and just kind of enjoy the beauty of the patterns.
We're talking to Donna Ruff. In the past, you've worked with books and newspapers,
right,
and things like that. And something that I've always wanted to ask artists who work this way but have felt that it was impolite to do so was, what does it mean when you're using a book and making an art exhibition in which the text is not read?
That's a very good question. Books are containers of knowledge by definition, I mean, and by usage. And I know that some people are troubled by taking the text out of a book or doing something to it that takes away that very usage. But to me, I guess because I've had this interest in books and language and text for all these years, and I think of my altered books as just a different way of perceiving that particular book. But I'll tell you a little story. Louise Bourgeois, of course, you know who she is.
The artist.
She has salons at her house every Sunday, and she asks artists to come and bring objects for her to look at. And so I brought one of my book objects, which was two books in French that I had gotten in Paris, and they were in the dumpster, okay? They really were. And I had taken the text out and kind of made them talking to each other and showed this to her, and she was appalled. She said, "How could you do that to books?" And I told her that they were in the dumpster, and she said, "No, the French never throw anything away."
So she didn't believe you.
She did not believe. Well, she didn't care, actually. She's at a point in her life where she knows what she knows, and that's it.
Yeah.
But anyway, it just was kind of funny because some people do have that reaction that books really should be revered, and I do revere books, and I think they're wonderful.
I'm not saying about revering them. It's a different way of using them. But for example, there was this very interesting looking exhibition that is on your website where you took the front page of a daily newspaper of a city, and every single day kept that paper, made them into a sort of translucent object,
right,
hung them all together, and in this year, one of the politicians in that city was being tried for corruption,
right,
or something like that. And
the
so
governor.
There's a sort of,
yeah.
But nobody's going to read them. So what does it mean when you have these things that aren't actually?
Well, I kind of disagree that nobody's going to read them because I think that when we read things, we kind of just take bits and pieces of it with us anyway. And I was a graphic designer for many years, so I'm thinking about the architecture of the page itself because they were all laid out and they were all visible to a certain extent.
So you actually could
sit
there and read them.
You totally could read them. Not that anybody would, you know, but the idea of it was to really be sort of astonished by the vastness of this entire year being put in this one installation.
Donna Ruff is an artist who's a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and her work will be shown along with Michael Broman and Alana DiGiacomo tomorrow, Thursday, at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. For more information, you can call 424-5050, and you can also go to the sfai.org website. I want to thank you all so much for being here, Donna, Alana, and Michael.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features some new CD releases. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.